My Mac Mini, not so mini actually, podcast number 13, sponsored by Small Dog Electronics and Innotech.com.
Hello, this is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration segment 13. As I hope you can hear, I'm back in my normal studio setup this week after last week's on the road in the back of the car exploits. As those of you who read the website will know, I was at Mac Expo London this week. There wasn't an awful lot there that was directly relevant to the Mac Windows interface, with the exception of Parallels, whose distributor in the UK had a stand, admittedly very small, but they did have presence there. So in the absence of anything from the Mac Expo directly related to fenestration topics, I want to talk a little bit about Microsoft Office, and more specifically, Visual Basic for Applications. Now VBA is the macro coding language that is included with Office that allows you to automate Office functions. At its most basic form, you can select a series of keystrokes, menu, commands, that sort of thing, and record them at the same time as you're doing them, and it creates a VBA macro, which you can then replay. As an example, you might have a simple set of keystrokes that you need to do on a regular basis, like paste some boilerplate text directly into a document, and you might want to do this from a function key rather than actually run through the menu commands. Now you can do that with a VBA macro. You basically would do it once while the record function for the macro creation software was running, and once you've done that, you could assign that macro to a function key, and every time you press that function key, the same set of actions will be repeated. However, as its name might suggest, Visual Basic for Applications is actually considerably more functional and advanced than that. At its largest, what you can do is create entire applications that run within the Office suite with their own forms, their own variables and functions, and basically anything you could do in a standalone visual creation environment using a programming language. The difference with VBA is it's all running on the Office core, which means that you can take advantage of Office features within your applications. As an example of this more advanced functionality, within my own Office environment, we have a set of spreadsheets that contain information from our project planning applications. These spreadsheets reconcile what we said we would do on a job in terms of man days with what we've actually done on a job in man days, and also include the expenses. These spreadsheets also include a set of macros that can be run to amend and quantify the information that's presented. This makes the spreadsheets a very useful tracking tool when it's coming to decide how much we should invoice a client each month. Now these macros do actually run like mini applications. When you click on the button, you get a whole form come up with populated with a set of fields, and you can then amend the information in the fields, and the macro will go away outside the spreadsheet and query the back-end database and repopulate the spreadsheet with the appropriate information. They're really quite sophisticated. Like so many things in Microsoft Office, this sort of functionality is something that probably 70% of people don't ever use. But for the 30% who do use it, they use it really hard, and it's very important to them. Now the reason I'm rattling on about this is because about 2 months ago the Microsoft Business Unit that creates Macintosh applications, known as MacBU, they have a blog on the internet that basically talks about the things they're doing, and they announced in that blog that they were actually withdrawing support for Visual Basic for Applications in the next version of Microsoft Office for Mac. Now I didn't report this at the time because, first of all, I wasn't really sure exactly what they were saying they were and weren't going to do. There was an awful lot of comment about alternatives and various other things they might be able to do to compensate. And so really what I wanted to do was to wait a while and see what actually happened before I reported this to you. However, in the meantime, I have to say they've been very strangely quiet on the issue, which is a little unusual bearing in mind the absolute furore that whipped up when they first announced it. The issue for Mac users is this. If you open a Microsoft Word document or a Microsoft Excel document that's been created by a Windows user and it creates a macro, and you open it in the Mac version of Office, currently you can run that application, you can run those macros within the Mac version. With the next version of Office, you won't be able to do that. If you round-trip the file and save it back, Microsoft says that the macro will be retained, but you won't be able to run it on the Mac version because there will be no support for VBA there at all. However, what's not being made clear at this point is what the implications of this truly are. If you round-trip the file, make changes, what does that actually mean in terms of the macro? Microsoft say you will be able to save the file back without damaging the macro. But on the spreadsheet, for instance, what happens if you make changes to the spreadsheet? Those changes might actually impact how the macro works. Typically, users will tend to use hidden parts of a spreadsheet to actually contain working for a VBA macro. Now, you might inadvertently overwrite those. And of course, if you've got no VBA support at all, you can't even run the macro to check that it still works before you save the file back. That's quite aside from the problem that you won't be able to run the macros, which means you won't be able to take advantage of the functionality that the Windows user has built into the file. Of course, all of this is assuming that when you actually save the file back, that macro is retained and is not damaged in any way. There's no guarantee of that, and again, you can't actually check to see whether that happens without opening up in the Windows side of the application. Bearing in mind one of the strong points of the Microsoft Office suite for Mac users has always been its strong affinity and compatibility with the Windows side, the fact that a major part of the functionality is now going to be missing with the next version, to my mind, weakens the idea of the whole suite. There is also a worry that this might be the thin end of the wedge, and in fact the two sets of applications, the Windows and Mac versions of Office, will start to fundamentally diverge going forward in the future. Now, the Mac BU have given all sorts of reasons as to why they've had to remove VBA from their next version of Office, and they basically blame it on the migration to the Intel platform. They've issued many pages of documentation and explanation talking about the various different ways that these VBA support within Mac works and how it differs from the Windows version and basically how difficult it will be to recreate it under the Intel side of the Macintosh. What it boils down to is that ultimately they don't think it's cost effective to do the work. Now, I work in business, I'm a realist, and I understand the economics of this sort of situation. What annoys me about it is that they've allowed themselves to get this situation in the first place. Their explanations make lots of references to the age of the code and the architecture of the code that they're trying to migrate. Well, hey guys, it's your code. You invented it in the first place. And maybe if you kept it a bit more up to date and re-architectured it as appropriate rather than just building on the ancient code that's been in there for years and years and years, you might find it more easy to move it from one platform to another. Another point to make is that this announcement was made by Microsoft in August of this year. That's just over 12 months after Apple announced that they were migrating to Intel. It is hard to believe that it took them that long to decide and identify the problem and do something about it. We are not talking about a small mom-and-pop operation here in terms of software development. We're talking about a company that is, in fact, the largest software developer on the planet. The fact that they are not proactively revising and redesigning their software with each release is really, really irritating to me. The Xcode platform that makes porting applications from PowerPC to Intel has been available from Apple for absolutely ages. And it stuns me that between releases they've not been working on polishing the code and migrating it to the latest development platform. Now, I said that I've been waiting to see what actually developed from this and whether Microsoft would offer any other alternatives for dealing with this situation, or maybe even reconsider the decision. They say they can't reconsider the decision because there's 2 years of development work involved in bringing VBA up to scratch and getting it available on the Intel platform. They have suggested Apple Script Studio as an alternative development platform for creating Office applications. Apple Script Studio is free and is available from Apple and does offer a very similar development environment to that included with Visual Basic for applications. However, it's not integrated with the Office suite. It doesn't have any specific Apple scripts hooks into the Office suite, and unless Microsoft provides them, that's actually going to be a considerably worse development platform for Office applications than VBA was. It's also not cross-platform compatible, which really was the whole point of VBA in the first place. Obviously, we don't create applications in Visual Basic on the Mac platform, except when we're doing them in Office. To my mind, unless Microsoft is going to provide a tool with Office 2007 that actually automatically creates AppleScript applications from existing VBA scripts and then also saves VBA scripts back out from AppleScript applications if they've been created on the Mac platform, then that really isn't a cross-platform solution and doesn't really help all that much. Now, you could use Bootcamp or Parallels to run the Windows version of Office 2007. But the problem with that is that you've got to pay for a copy of Windows, and no doubt you'll have to pay for a copy of the PC version of Office 2007 as well. I don't see Microsoft providing a PC-compatible license along with the Mac version when you buy the Mac version of Office because of this problem. You can't even opt to stay with the older version of Microsoft Office 2004 because there's no guarantee that will be compatible with the VBA developed under Office 2007 on the PC side. And they're also changing the file formats again, so there's no guarantee you'll even be able to open a file created in Office 2007 in Office 2004. I do hope there's further developments on this as time goes on between now and the release of Office 2007 for Mac. As soon as anything happens, I'll let you know. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
One of the most important preference settings in all of Apple software is within iTunes. As soon as you launch iTunes, let's do this together here in real time. Go to iTunes, upper left, right next to your blue Apple, and come down to Preferences and then click. And then over along the top, you'll see General, Podcast, etc. Near the right of that upper area is Advanced. Click on Advanced and then click on Importing. Once you're in the Importing tab, the area that I'm talking about now is Import Using. Now, when you get your computer or when you start using iTunes the first time, it's set to AAC Encoder, Import Using AAC Encoder, setting High Quality 128kbps. The settings that I use are a little bit different, and let's talk about that. But the important thing is I want you to realize this is within your control, and it will make a difference. But first, we're going to look at a review that Owen Rubin did on October the 3rd of 2006 for the Shure Series Integrated Sound Isolating Earphones and Mobile Headset. You'll find that by going to mymac.com, click on Archives, scroll down to Owen Rubin, and then you'll see his Features Archive 2006, second from the top. Within that review, Owen makes a very important point that the higher quality your speakers, and especially your headphones and earphones are, the greater the discrepancy between the pure high-quality recorded sound and the compressed audio, whether it's AAC or MP3, and it doesn't matter what those letters and numbers stand for, but the point is, if you compress your audio to have it take up less space on your hard disk or iPod, so you can get more songs in the same space, you're actually reducing the audio quality of the given recording that you're importing. Back to our iTunes Preferences Advanced Importing panel. Oh, by the way, this is John Nemo, and thanks for joining us on mymac.com mini podcast number 13, and this feature is called All Over the Mac. I use import using MP3, and the reason for that is being a music teacher occasionally, well, fairly frequently, I need to give songs to other people to use for their learning purposes. And it's just a lot easier to use MP3 because it's a world standard, and whether or not they have iTunes or not, they can relate to MP3. But most people will import using AAC Encoder. So that's what we're going to use today. So import using AAC Encoder. And you see where it says setting high quality 128kbps? Well, drop down below where it says play songs while importing or converting. I uncheck that because it gets on my nerves. I have checked automatically retrieve CD track. I have checked create file names. And I also have checked use error correction when reading audio CDs. That means if there's any problem in bringing the CD in, it generally goes away. I haven't had any trouble importing since I started checking using error correction, but there's a good chance that that's not checked on your iTunes preferences. So import using AAC encoder, setting high quality 128K PBS, and then click on that high quality and come down to custom and then click again. It opens up a new window called AAC encoder, stereo bit rate, sample rate, channels, use variable, etc. Where it says stereo bit rate, hold that down and you've got numbers all the way from 16K PBS, which is very, very low quality and very sort of dull sounding, all the way up to 320 KPBS, KBPS, which is the highest quality we have available to us within iTunes. My buddy David Weeks converted all 510 of his personally owned CDs to Apple's iTunes at the bit rate of 320 KBPS. He had already done them once before, I think at 256, but he did them all again because he was noticing a slight improvement in quality at 320 and a slight deterioration in quality at 256 or whatever he had them at. Now, so I did a test. I'm reviewing some very nice, reasonably priced Bose over-the-ear headphones. They cost about $140. They're called the Triport, and I'll be reviewing those soon. And I had some songs that I had done at the setting that I use for importing tracks for listening to my car, which is 192 MP3. And I was definitely hearing hiss and noise and artifacts from the importing and from the, what do we call it? From the audio compression. And then I took it up at progressively higher and higher and higher settings. And by the time I was up to 320, I mean, to tell you the truth, it was CD quality. What do you lose when you go to 320? The only thing you lose is it takes a little bit longer to import them, and it uses up considerably more space on your iPod or your hard drive or in your iTunes music library. So when you're done listening to this, I want you to take some really important music, stuff that's extremely important to you, and take one song that's one of your absolute favorites and import it, you know, about three or four different times, starting at 128, 160, etc. Go all the way up to 320 and let me know if you can hear any difference. But what I have found is there definitely is a hidden setting in iTunes Preferences, Advanced Importing. For some reason, Apple's default setting, AAC 128 High Quality, they make you think that you're getting the best possible sound. But in fact, there are, how many, is it six different? Hang on a second. One, two, three. There's five settings higher than 128, between 160 and 320, that will definitely improve, especially if you want audio file quality. And really, if you're listening through high quality earphones, headphones, earbuds, whatever you want to call them, like the ones that I will be reviewing soon from Bose, their Triport. Thanks so much for listening to the MyMac.com mini podcast number 13. John Nemo signing off until next time with our this week's segment of All Over the Mac.
Hey everyone, Tim Robertson here. If I sound a little funny, it's because my voice is I don't know, it's a little hoarse today. It's a little scratchy. And I'm actually recording this on Sunday, a little after 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You could do the math and figure out what time it is at your area when I was recording this. Over the last weekend here, my wife and I went on a weekend getaway. It was something that we both needed to do, and we found a babysitter for the kids, and it was just the two of us. It was a great time. Went up to a little place called Frankenmuth here in Michigan. It's about a 2.5-hour drive for us, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on the traffic and the weather. Well, if you listen to the original podcast that came out Friday of last week, I was talking about that I bought a new car. And what I bought was a Chevy Suburban, which gets horrible gas mileage, has many more miles on it than my current car, and is older. So it's almost like I went in reverse It's I didn't move ahead and went backwards, but it was something that we had to get because, you know, with three kids, trying to fit them all in the back of my Pontiac was starting to become an issue. The older girls, they were getting a little smushed back there, or their knees were hitting the seats in front of them, and I just can't really have that. So we had to get something bigger. I've owned two Suburbans in the past. I owned one in the 90s, and I owned one in the 80s, so I had to own one in the 2000s. Anyway, so we got the Suburban, and the day I actually went over to record the podcast, which was Thursday night last week, when I left, my window wipers weren't working. And that's kind of a... I mean, this was the first day I owned the truck. And, let's see, I believe I actually bought it on... Boy, it might have been Thursday, the same day. I can't remember. Maybe it was Wednesday that I bought it. Anyways, it's less than 24 hours owning it, the window wiper stopped working. It was kind of, oh boy, what are you going to do now? Well, I bought it from a small dealer. I actually couldn't stand the people who were selling the car. They were jerks. But that's neither here nor there. It was a good vehicle. And I was steered towards it by a trustworthy person. So that's what I purchased. And for the most part, I will say it's been a great vehicle. But anyway, so the window wiper stopped working. A little thing called a pulse motor? Pulse something, I don't know. Really common on these type of wiper blades or wiper motors, goes out quite a bit. When my father works at an auto parts store, he called a couple mechanics. I said, yeah, it's probably a little pulse thing in there. And it's not difficult to change, and that's probably all I needed to do. I probably didn't need a whole new wiper motor. But the thing is, it started working the very next day, Friday. It worked great. But I still bought the part. It was $11 my cost. So I bought it, and I didn't have time to change it before my wife and I were leaving. So I had it in the truck, and we're heading up to Frankenmuth. Excuse me, that's my voice. You'll find out why in a second why my voice is probably a little scratchy tonight. We're heading up to Frankenmuth, and we're just past Lansing, Michigan, where I-69 turns into I-75. And it's raining pretty hard. Earlier in the day, I had actually stopped, maybe an hour before, and put new wiper blades on the car because I noticed they were kind of streaky. And if you've ever driven a car in the rain and the wiper blades don't work quite that well, well, you know, I don't have to explain how irritating and potentially dangerous a streaky windshield can be. So I put new wiper blades on there. They were still working great. And, everything was good to go. And I really wasn't thinking about how they had stopped working on Friday. Or on Thursday. Because, you know, they were working fine. But I did have that $11 part in the trunk. Well, in the back. There's no trunk in a Suburban. So we're on this I-75, and I'm doing about 70 miles an hour. I'm not one who usually speeds. I usually go whatever the posted speed limit is, and it was 70 miles an hour. It's raining pretty hard, and the traffic is pretty thick. I mean, it's not bumper to bumper, but it's by no means a deserted highway either. So my wife and I are in the truck, and we're talking along, and all of a sudden, on a downward motion of the wiper blades, they just stopped right there. Boom. Done. And being a guy, of course, I said, oh, shit. And immediately, well, slowly made my way to the side of the highway. It wasn't much of a shoulder to the road, and it was a pretty big drop-off right there. And couldn't see very much because it was, you know, pouring rain. A big 18-wheeler semi-trucks driving by, shaking the whole truck as they pass because they're passing so close. And I had to get out of the vehicle and try to fix it. Obviously, I couldn't really fix it right there on the side of the highway. Number one, it was very dark. In number two, it was very dangerous. Working on a vehicle on the side of a highway isn't the smartest thing. Working on a vehicle at night in the pouring rain, doubly so. So, what was I supposed to do? My wife and I can't just sit there all night long. We're too far away, really, for an emergency phone call into, I don't know, Chad or somebody like that that could possibly come out and pick us up. And I didn't want to endanger anybody else out there on the roads. So I popped the hood and couldn't see anything. The light underneath my engine hood doesn't work. Or even if there's one there, I'm not sure. I'm sure there is. It just doesn't work. So what's a guy supposed to do? Well, I grab my iPod. It's in a protective case. What the heck, right? I grab my iPod and turned it on. And I tell you what, the light from the iPod allowed me to see pretty well the wiper motor. And I wiggled the wires in there, and it started working. And I got back in the truck, and they stopped. And then I got back out and wiggled and wiggled and wiggled the wires a little bit more. And they worked. And so I limped the truck as safely, but as quickly as I possibly could, off the highway to the next exit. Pulled into a truck stop, gas station, whatever you want to call it. And had to replace that little pulse motor thing. And thankfully it worked just fine after that, and the rest of the weekend, well, I don't want to say it went off without a hitch. We stayed in two horrible hotels. The first one, the hotel itself was pretty nice, but all they had left available, see, here's the thing, my wife and I didn't make a reservation. I know, stupid. But it added to the adventure. We didn't know where we were going to stay. And I won't make that mistake again. But the first one we stayed at, the beds were so hard. And I say beds because they didn't have a single bed, like a king-size bed or something. So my wife and I, the first time in, I don't even know how long, actually slept in separate beds, which was really weird. I woke up the next morning, my back was killing me because it felt like I had slept on plywood. It was horrible. And but it was in the town of Frankenmuth, so, you know, we dealt with it. The next night, Saturday night, we couldn't get any hotels in Frankenmuth or at the next two exits. And the one we did find, it looked okay, so we, and it was half the price of what we were expecting to pay, so we got that one. And it turned out it was a pretty bad neighborhood, and it was a pretty crappy hotel room. I think I got maybe, for me this was last night, maybe 2 hours worth of sleep total. I kept waking up. It was too hot in the room. To me, to my wife, it was too cold. It's probably the story of most married guys, right? If it's too hot for you, it's too cold for your wife, or vice versa. And it was just miserable in the hotel rooms. But beyond that, we had a great time this weekend, and it was a lot of fun. If you're in the Michigan area and you've never been to Frankenmuth, check them out. Do a Google search for Frankenmuth, Michigan. They've got the biggest Christmas store in the world there. At least it's advertised as such. We shot there and bought some Christmas decorations and stuff. It was great. It was fun. And it was a good time. It really was. Had a chicken dinner that was fabulous. And bought some really unique gifts. And there's a military museum that, the very tiny museum, we didn't actually go in, but they have a Sherman tank and a airplane out front. I took a picture of my new Suburban in front of the tank. If you want to see that picture, go up to the show notes for My Mac Mini podcast number 13. It won't be on the main page. You actually have to click it and go to the notes page, the article page, if you will. I'll put a picture up there of my truck and the tank. Well, coming up on the rest of the podcast, we have Robert Hazelrig, and of course, Not Mac News with Guy Searle. And we're going to play second to the last segment from Guy, Tim, and Chad up at the Grand Rapids Hotel the day before our 100th podcast. I forgot to put that segment in last week, to be honest. That's my bad. So this is going to be actually a long mini podcast. If you can't listen to it at all of it, you know, that's cool, I understand. If you can, cool. We'd love to hear feedback from you. Simply send an email to mymacpodcast@gmail.com. The rest of the podcast is sponsored by smalldog.com and innotech.com. And I just want to personally say thanks for listening, and I'll see you guys Friday with the original podcast.
Robert Hazelrig here with another Speed E-Review. This week I'd like to tell you about two fashion products that work with your iPod. The first one is the Levi's Redwire. Before I get started, I want to tell you that Levi's are the jeans of choice as far as I'm concerned, and I don't buy any other pair of jeans. That said, the Levi's Redwire jeans are not something I recommend. So why do I dislike these jeans so much when I'm such a Levi's fan? Well, to start with, the control panel seemed bulky and awkward. I just could not figure out the little rubber nipple joystick controller. I always seemed to be going the opposite way I wanted to be going when I toggled back and forth. Then there's the headphone unit, which is another big bulky box that's also on your right hip now. These two things that are now protruding out of your right side take up a lot more space than an iPod in a case with a clip that I could clip to my pocket or my belt. Finally, there's the price tag. These jeans cost $250. I'm sorry, but that just seems nuts to me. I don't know about you, but I'll stick to the $25 pair of Levi's and hang my iPod on a clip off my belt. That is, unless of course it's cold outside. If it's cold outside, then I'm going to wear my new jacket from Kenpo. Unlike the Levi's jeans, I did like the Kenpo jacket. Now, they have a variety of different styles, so you'll need to go to their site to decide which is the right jacket for you. But what makes this jacket so cool? Well, again, it has a specially designed pocket for your iPod to fit into. It also has a little dock connector that you connect your iPod to. Once you connect it to your iPod and lock the iPod, then it has some controls on the sleeve of the jacket that allow you to volume up and down and toggle back and forth and pause your songs. Now, it doesn't come with any cheap headphones, but that's okay. I don't use cheap headphones. I will say this about the Kenpo jacket and the controls themselves. The controls on the sleeve are very convenient, and it's a pretty cool idea to put them there because if it is cold outside and you don't want to keep opening your jacket or taking your iPod out of your pocket, it is convenient and discreet. There was one downside to this jacket that I didn't particularly care for, and that is the responsiveness of the controls themselves. One of the things you have to do after you plug your iPod in and lock the iPod is you have to hold down one of the buttons on the sleeves for at least 3 seconds before the iPod will start to respond. Now, I guess this is a good thing because, you know, if you're a klutz and you typically bump your arm into things, you don't want to be inadvertently changing tracks or adjusting the volume. But I myself would like to have much more responsive control. One thing I do like about the controls is they're nearly invisible, unlike the Levi's jeans where you've got this giant white orb sticking out of your right hip. These controls are nearly invisible to the naked eye. You really have to look to find them. And they're not uncomfortable at all. You almost don't even know that they're there. The Kenpo jacket sells for $140, which is fairly reasonable as far as I'm concerned. Most coats cost $140. I have yet to try it in the very, very cold winter months. It is only September here at the Jersey Shore. And It's only gotten to be about 40 degrees a couple of times so far this year. If I was to rate this coat in a scale of 1 to 5, I'd give it a 4. I did like it. Again, it's just the responsiveness of the controls that I would like to be a little bit sharper. If I was going to rate the Levi's jeans on a scale of 1 to 5, well, let's just say it would definitely be below 3. So there you have it. 2 fashion products for your iPod. One I definitely recommend, and the other I definitely don't. This has been Robert Hazelrig with a speedy review. Thanks for listening.
Good evening. This is Not Mac News. I'm your host, Guy Searle. Send any comments to notmacnews@gmail.com. Dateline, North America. Apple's Intel strategy seems to be rolling right along, with all of their products now moved over to the world's best-known semiconductor manufacturer. It doesn't seem that long ago that Intel was perceived as being firmly in the enemy camp when it came to the Macintosh platform. However, this isn't the first time that corporate America has had a collective bout of amnesia. Some other examples include Leona Helmsley of the Helmsley Hotel fame forgetting to pay her income taxes over a number of years, Martha Stewart not recalling that she had received insider information just before selling off all of her ImClone drug stock, former chairwoman Patricia Dunn losing track of just when she hired private investigators to spy on HP board members, the Walmart Corporation for failing to recollect the close to 500,000 employees without health care coverage, former CEO Michael Eisner forgetting that the only movies over the last 15 years of Disney's that made money and didn't suck were created by Pixar, Adobe Corporation's continuous lack of being able to find universal binaries for their most popular products, and lastly, every Macintosh web and print writer for conveniently overlooking how many times they said Intel processors blow chunks over the years. Not Mac News. I had a great closing joke, but I can't quite seem to recall it. I'm Guy Searle, and I wish you a good night.
I would also say that most of the technology that we're using that we're enamored with to one point or another was developed
for men.
By men.
Yeah.
And that we're just more readily accepting of it.
Except for the pink iPod, but let's
yes.
not go there.
Well,
Raspberry, it's Raspberry.
I personally think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. I think, and we talked about this actually.
Well, I think it'll sell. I mean, I think that, and you know, the pink MIDI
sold
like crazy.
They can't keep them up on eBay. When someone sells one up on eBay, they're gone immediately, especially if it's a buy it now.
Well, if you look on the Apple Store, the refurb mm-hmm. section, mm-hmm. they've got minis on there. No pink ones.
No pink ones, exactly. Yeah. Chad and I and Tad Sheeler, April of 2005, when we did the bonus podcast that wasn't really Mac related, mm-hmm. we talked about industrial design.
Right.
That it's all square boxes still. And mm-hmm. it's either a silvery finish or a black finish, and that they're obviously weren't designed with women's tastes in mind, and that Apple was one of the few companies designing products at the time, obviously the Mac Mini, but the original Barbie purse looking iBook as well, mm-hmm. that they designed them with a woman's sensibilities and sense of design in mind. And I think that's
important.
The
toilet bowl iBook.
Yes. Yeah.
The flower power iMac.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. You just got. You had to go there.
Yeah, I did.
So I think if
what
Apple
lovely floral pattern that was.
Apple is smart
so well
to do it
with everything I have.
If you look at the new Zune, that's a guy product.
Especially the brown one.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no woman gonna
look,
buy.
Look, it looks like crap.
All right.
No woman's gonna want a Zune. It there's nothing feminine about it.
Well, you know, no. they say the DRM WMA files sound like crap to begin with, so you may as well have a player that's gonna emphasize
that. That's right. Yeah. I'm not very impressed with the Zune on any level. I can't figure out why Microsoft wants to bother getting into that market. Wouldn't Microsoft be much better served breaking that company up into three divisions, an operating system, an office productivity slash internet,
and
then consumer electronics. Yeah. The Xbox 360 is an amazing, even though mine's busted after 2.5 months, thank you, Microsoft, although they're fixing it for free.
Sure. But you won't have it until
for
it's fixed.
3 weeks, probably, right. At least. It's an amazing product. And their live marketplace for Xbox Live, where you can download games and buy games and stuff like that, the user experience is the best I've ever seen for an online anything when it comes to that.
And
it's
yet,
fantastic.
They've yet to make a dime from it.
Well, they're going to make their money through licensing. Mm-hmm. And that's the only company
now,
that
wait,
seems
wait.
When to
you
make...
talk about licensing, are you talking about...
Anytime you make an Xbox game, you have to pay Microsoft licensing fees.
Now, does it work the same way for Sony and the PlayStation?
Yes. That's how they make their money.
Well, what's to keep someone from just making a game that'll work on the Xbox and not pay the license fee?
Well, you'd have to reverse engineer it first, and then you're going to have to get into the store second. True. Both of those are going to be very tall tasks to... And it was a little bit more of a free spirit, more outlawish back in the Sega Genesis days where people did try to do that.
Yeah.
But it's pretty tightly controlled now. When you figure that the vast majority of all games sold is from four places: Target, Walmart, Best Buy, and Amazon.
Yeah.
And if you're making bootleg products and you can't get into there, you're probably not making a dent into that profit anyways.
Even if you get it, manage to get it reviewed on IGN or something.
So why not give up whatever the percentage is, say 15% of every sale to Microsoft when you can hit those four places
and
you're
going to
sell.
A ton more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it really doesn't make any sense. The only company that's making any profit right now off a game console is Nintendo.
Yep.
Nintendo just announced this last week the Wii, and they gave all the specifications. It's going to launch, I think it was November 11th.
Just in time for the Christmas holiday.
Imagine that. And it's only $250.
Yep.
So it's half the price of Microsoft, and it's a quarter of the price of the next PlayStation 3, which launches the same weekend.
They're talking what? For the full-blown PlayStation with everything on it?
$599, $699, $699,
something like that?
That's $599, and then they got a they call it the base unit, I think, for $499. And Microsoft went the same route. They had a $299 and... they had a...
$399.
And a $499, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even then, they're no longer... they're dedicated game consoles.
They're computers.
But they're computers.
Right. What gets me is... how is it then that Nintendo, when they come out with the Wii, they're saying from day one they're making a profit on each sale of the Wii? How are they doing it? Because they're not going for horsepower. They're not putting the Blu-ray discs in. They're not putting the power...
No, Nintendo's never done that. You look at the GameCube,
right?
And those little discs for the GameCube,
yep.
You can't use them for anything.
No, correct.
Nobody makes anything like
that. Well, and the other thing is Nintendo's good about not investing in cutting bleeding-edge technologies.
They're more focused on gameplay.
They use state-of-the-market equipment that they know is reliable, so that the kids that use the Nintendo, which basically it's more geared towards kids,
right,
are going to have a good user experience.
Well, after the Atari joystick, everything went to game pads.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, that's what we still use today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Nintendo Wii isn't like that. It's a remote control that you move up and down, left and right, forward and back, and that's what controls your your character.
Have you seen this work yet?
Yeah, and it's amazing looking. You point it at the TV. Say you're going to aim at someone. Uh-huh. You just aim the remote and push the button, and it shoots the gun or whatever it is. Or he shoots the arrow.
Plus, it has a few feedback mechanisms, too, because I heard
reviews
of guys that were playing the tennis, and they said it was pretty amazing when you hit that ball. It felt like...
And it's got a little speaker built right into the controller, so you get a little bit of a little sound right there. So I think Nintendo is more like Apple in that they're not...
They're not focused
rehashing the same thing over and over, and they're not looking at just raw horsepower and saying, well, we have the best graphics and...
Yeah, but the problem is, if nobody makes games for it, then...
But I think they will for the Wii, because
I mean for... Like, you look at the PSP. You guys have talked about this before.
Yeah.
The PSP is really some amazing tech.
Right. Yeah.
We're getting rehashed PS2 games.
Right.
Or even worse, PS1 games.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, you're just now, and it's been out over a year now, just now beginning to see some more original content for the PSP games.
Right.
Whereas,
more and more movie studios are dropping movies.
I think that was always a bad idea to begin with.
Yeah.
They should have, if they wanted to release movies for the PSP, they should have came out with an online store and let you sync it remotely with your PSP or plug it in via USB and send it that
or
way.
Or memory sticks.
Well, you know, how big is the memory stick that comes with
this? Or even better, come out with a UMD burner.
32 meg.
Yeah. Where that, you can burn your own discs.
Right. Mm-hmm. That would be, well, but then you're talking about a whole different proprietary storage set that nobody else is supporting that's really unnecessary when you look at flash memory and SD cards that you can get 4 or 6 gigabytes, which is more than enough to hold a movie
but
and
what's
all
the biggest memory stick?
Oh, I think they're up to 8 gigs now.
Are they?
Yeah. And they're quite expensive, but with Sony's power on being able to buy in bulk, they should have shipped it with at least 1 gig of memory. Mm-hmm. Instead, they shipped it 32 megs, which is nothing. Yep. It's insulting.
It was almost a slap in the face.
But by the same token, it is a technically superior game console than the DS.
And the DS.
And yet, you look at the DS and the type of games they have and the innovation that they put into those games. And Nintendo doesn't rely on third-party developers to create the games to sell their system. They create the games themselves. Mm-hmm. Zelda, Mario, you know, they mm-hmm. come out with these
Animal
games.
Crossing.
Animal
That's
Crossing.
Huge.
Exactly. They make the games. What's that? The puppy one?
Nintendogs.
Nintendogs. My kids were into that huge for a long time.
Brain
Age has
been with
kids.
Adults. Yeah.
Well, that's getting real big,
yeah.
too.
Mm-hmm. So Nintendo is a first-person vendor for their own platform. And they make these must-have games that take advantage of the technology.
And they're making money on both ends.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Instead of just on the one end, like
Nintendo,
Sony and Microsoft. Mm-hmm.
But here's the difference. When you think of Sony, and what do you think of? Electronics, right?
Yep,
right.
When you think of Microsoft, do you think of Xbox or games? No.
No, you think of software.
Software.
Right. What do you think when you think of Nintendo?
Games.
Nintendo does one thing, and one thing very well. They make games that are enjoyable. They don't make the best looking games. Mm-hmm. Who cares about graphics when it comes to gameplay? Really? I mean, did the crappy graphics on Pac-Man stop us from dropping quarter after quarter?
Or Berserk, if you remember that.
Pong.
There you go.
When Pong came out.
Get all the humanoids.
Stop all intruders.
That's right. You know, I don't think graphics make the game. It can enhance
the
gaming experience.
Gameplay should be number one.
Right.
And that's what so many of the game makers forget.
Yep.
You know, they come out with these first-person shooters that look fantastic.
Yep.
But they're boring to play because it's all repetitious, the same repetitious crap they've done before.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Look at the most popular Xbox Live game. It's what? Geometry Wars, which is all vector graphics.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. I mean, it'll give you a seizure if you watch it,
you know,
but still,
to bring it back to the Mac a little bit. I'm sure you guys have logged many an hour in Marathon.
Sure. Back in the day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Chad ever did. For Chad, it was probably StarCraft.
Yep.
Well, see,
He still plays StarCraft.
I do.
I remember seeing Doom on the PC before it was available on the Mac.
Yeah.
And I was blown away. I was like,
didn't Doom come out on the Mac first?
No,
it was PC first.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Descent.
Right, Descent, I think, was Mac first.
And Wolfenstein, that came out of the
Wolfenstein was PC.
Was that PC, too?
Yeah, it did PCs first, so.
But then when Marathon came out, Marathon was actually the first game I played that
cel-shaded and...
Well, not only that, it wasn't even really the graphics. It was the way that the game made me feel as I played it.
Yeah, it was very fluid.
And, and I felt apprehensive going around corners.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would feel the fear. It was like, ooh, am I going to see that backward knees guy with the friggin' staff that would shoot something at me?
Well, there was a game on...
Well, let's talk about another breakthrough game that company did, because that was Bungie, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was Myth.
Myth was... that was like one of my favorite games for a long time.
Yeah. Myth was... I can't tell you how many hours that I spent online playing Myth. I mean, it was fantastic.
It was all squad-based tactics.
There was a good reason why Microsoft bought them.
Yep. Yeah. And
they were doing something that was... excuse me, I'm sorry. They were doing something that was actually innovative in the game industry. They weren't just repackaging the same
stuff.
Well,
that and the game that they were working on, Halo. Which was going to come out on the Mac first.
Yep.
It was going to be a Mac game,
yeah,
Halo.
That was announced at Macworld 2000, I think, in New York, was it? Or was it 2001?
No, it was E3, I think.
No, it was a Macworld that they announced Halo. Yeah. And Microsoft bought them shortly thereafter, which really pissed a lot of Mac users.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know...
You can bet their forums.
Mac, gaming on a Mac is still pretty big. We don't focus on it hardly at all at MyMac.com. And that's partly because I don't play games on my Mac. Should I? I probably should, but...
Well, it would be nice, but, I mean, we're all married. You know? Right. We got kids, we got jobs.
And I've got all the game consoles. And I think when you have a game console, the games are generally easier to play.
Yeah.
I can't stand pulling out a new Mac game and having to learn. I have to put 50 different commands in the keyboard to get anything done. I can't stand... If I can't use the mouse and maybe the arrow keys, anything more than that, it starts turning me off.
Well, have you tried... I was going to review this, but I just never got around to it because every time I would start to play it, I would just get lost in it. Roller Coaster Tycoon.
No, I've seen it, and it looked kind of cool, but I never really got into it. My brother-in-law did on the PC.
It is an amazing game.
Yeah.
It really, really is. And the cool thing is, you know, you can certainly buy the pre-made coasters and drop them into your park and all that, but where it's really fun is making your own coasters.
Yeah.
You can decide whether it's going to be wooden or steel rails or above or below or however it is you want to work it out. And you have to pay attention to the... sorry, my goodness.
The cold's getting them. Well, the sinus.
I'm dying here. You have to pay attention to the physics because it's not enough just to have them go down and start looping around. If it doesn't have enough momentum to go through whatever it is you're going to do, it'll just... And then start going backwards. Back
around again. Yeah, that's kind of annoying.
And that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
People aren't going to like a coaster like that.
And you also have to make sure you have bathrooms in the right areas.
Right.
And,
But after you build these coasters, then with like three different views, you can actually ride them.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And as you're riding them, you know, using your mouse or a couple of other things, you can be looking around at the rest of your park.
To see how what the view would be like.
Right. Sure.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
You know, the thing is, there's a lot of ideas for games still out there.
Sure.
And unfortunately, the gaming industry seems to think, wow, Grand Theft Auto is such a huge seller. And I love Grand Theft Auto, don't get me wrong.
Let's make another one.
Let's make another one, and another one, and another one. You know, I've been playing Saints Row on the 360.
Half-Life. Half-Life is Quake, is Doom, is this, is that.
And after a while, you're like, eh.
There are certain games that define a genre. You know, the third-person games were defined by Tomb Raider. The first-person perspective games were defined originally by Doom and by Quake.
Yep.
The kind of tycoon games were defined by Zoo Tycoon and Roller Coaster Tycoon.
Well, but before that, there was even...
Sid Meier's Civilization, which is basically what that is.
But at the same time, those were all... And well, for that
well
matter,
even SimCity, you know.
Well, SimCity and also Warcraft.
Well, no, you know, Warcraft
you're building villages.
But you're only doing that to gain minerals to buy better weapons so you can have a big-ass fight against your enemy. Because Warcraft, I would say Warcraft 2... / StarCraft was probably the games I've spent the most time playing. So when I say when I play games, I play console games. That's more true now than it was, you know, 8 years ago. I used to play those games religiously. Chad and I played a few times. We didn't play that often.
No.
What, online or...
Modem to modem. Because he didn't want to play me too much because I'd spank him at him.
Oh, yeah.
I was expecting a...
I owned you!
I played StarCraft a year before anybody else.
You beta tested it for...
Well, I didn't beta tested it. No. I asked them to review the game, and they said, we're at least a year away, I can send you the beta, and you can do a first look. And I was the first Mac place to have StarCraft. In fact, I was one of the first places anywhere to have a first look at StarCraft.
See, and I remember coming and seeing that when you were back on Park Avenue.
Yeah, and he was like, oh my God, I gotta play that.
I have this.
Yep. And I had at the time, more people linking to that because nobody else had it. But I did. And I don't know why Blizzard trusted me so much, but they did.
Fools.
They've sent me every game that's come out for the Mac. They sent me World of Warcraft, which I didn't give World Diablo. Of Warcraft that big of a game. Yeah, I did Diablo. I did all the StarCrafts. Mm-hmm. Well, there's only one.
Warcraft 3, pack. Diablo
Well, I did Warcraft, did they, Warcraft did 2, and Warcraft 3.
Did they update those to
Yes, that's the thing. And in fact, they just came out with a StarCraft patch just not too long ago. Another one. Mm-hmm. So they keep
talking
supporting
about these
it.
Games. You know, did you ever play Carmageddon?
Yeah, that was goofy.
That was my kids used to love this, and they didn't want to play it themselves that much. But there was this one section where you were going around, and there was all these clowns.
Yeah,
and they would love to see me run over the clowns. And the screaming that would happen every time I did it. They, and they would actually stand around the computer and pantomime, going as these clowns would go falling off of wherever it was they were going. They loved that.
Yeah, my kids like to play Saints Row, which is not a kids game at all. It has
Saints Row. I don't think I've heard of that.
It's an Xbox 360, but it's basically Grand Theft Auto.
Okay.
It just doesn't have the it's gangs and San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto. It's basically Grand Theft Auto. It looks better because it's on 360,
right?
But without the intelligent humor and the tongue in cheek, and a statement on society that Take-Two Interactive puts into Grand Theft Auto. But it's a lot of fun to play, especially driving around. I'll just turn down the volume, and the older kids will sit there and drive around in the cars. They'll jack a new car and drive it around, and they'll run people over. And I think that's kind of harmless. That's not going to cause them to go out and
do that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. I think there's...
Thanks for the car, Dad!
I mean, if they did it 24/7... listening to the vile language of the game,
right.
That I would have a problem with. But with me sitting there, or my wife sitting there, letting them play that, I don't think that's going to harm them at all. I really don't. But see, they'll also turn around and play Nintendogs. Or listen...
Now, if they could just run over their Nintendogs, they'd have it all.
Yeah, there you go. If I could run them over, I'd be happy. Stupid game. But I think that gaming should go in new directions. I think there's so many new ideas out there for people to do in gaming on both the Mac platform, PC, and game consoles. I just think they're lazy. They're just not doing it.
Well, they're just not coming up with original ideas.
Why, though?
Keep going the safe route.
Well, but do you know why? There's a reason for that.
Nobody wants to take a chance.
It's not that. It's that it's so expensive to get into the game.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you could have two or three guys, and they would crank out a game like Descent in 6 months and release it online, and it would be a pretty big hit. But even if it wasn't, it was just three guys who did it.
Right.
A game development nowadays takes hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge company. Well, they can't take a chance.
They can't afford a mistake.
I mean, if you look at Ambrosia, there's one that's been doing it for years, and those are usually just two or three guys, or maybe even one guy, but you have an extremely long lead time for developing those games.
Well, talking about Ambrosia, when was the last time you saw something... I mean, the last thing I can think of that was really great from Ambrosia was the...
Ambrosia's really good nowadays is with retreads.
Yeah, what's the game with the spaceships and your...
Yeah,
EVNova.
Yeah, EVNova.
Yeah, I've got that.
That's a great game.
Well, here's some games.
I'll tell you what was really good is I enjoyed Darwinia. I just played the demo. I haven't picked it up yet. Darwinia was actually... It's part real-time strategy, but it has this retro graphics feel. Really cool storyline. And it actually was up for several awards on IGN. So that's one worth looking at.
There's games that came out that I did reviews of that I thought were brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
The one that comes to mind is Food Chain. It was a brilliant idea for a game. It played fantastic. And it never did anything.
Now, what's the one from Freeverse?
The only thing I can think from Freeverse is the solitaire game. The monkey...
Monkey Solitaire?
No, not Burning Monkey Solitaire. It was the one... I mean, oddly enough, one of the first things I ever wrote for MyMac.com...
Oh, you're talking about Wingnuts.
Yes. Wingnuts.
Yeah. Well, that's now, a retread of Time Pilot.
You did the Wingnuts 2 review.
Like 2 years.
And it just came out.
It just came out. I didn't really do a review. It was more of a, hey, you know, I've seen some screenshots, and this looks really, really cool.
We got a lot of hits from that, too. A lot of places, because it was very anticipated. Mm-hmm. But if it takes 2 years to come out...
Exactly.
That's just too
and
long.
I've played it, and...
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's a retread.
Not only is it a retread, but they took the original concept, which was, you know, you're flying around and you're getting bigger planes and more weapons, and now they've turned it into this super complicated kind of kludge that's just not as much fun as the original one. Now, is it prettier?
Oh, yeah, it's prettier.
It is way prettier.
But it's no funner to play.
It's not. Yeah. It's not as much fun to play as the original.
Well, there's a reason that Chad to this day plays StarCraft because it's got excellent game mechanics and that
replayability.
You can play it over and over, but and chances are you probably win most of the battles when you get into them, right?
Sure.
Against a computer, but you never know. There's always that chance that they're going to beat you this time.
Yeah. Well, and what's odd about it is that it's a game that I will leave for several months or over a year sometimes. And then I'll just say, you know what?
I feel like playing StarCraft.
And yet Blizzard's still updating it to work with the most current version of Mac OS. That tells me a lot. Blizzard has my respect. Mm-hmm. And really,
what's the last thing they came out with?
World of Warcraft. The number one game in the world. World of Warcraft is so big, it's mind-boggling.
Well, it shut down EverQuest, more or less. What do you hear about anymore? Nothing.
World of Warcraft, I didn't give it that high of a review because I just couldn't imagine spending $15 a month
to play it.
To play it, and plus, it would cost you $50 just to buy the disc. And there's no offline play. The whole thing is online. That's the whole appeal of it. So for $50 plus $15 every month, if I want to play this game for the next year, how much is that going to cost me?
A lot.
A lot of money. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was going to be that big of a hit. I was absolutely wrong. It's a monster hit. Don't get me wrong. The gameplay is fun. But when you get right down to it, all the gameplay, I think they have level 60 is the highest you can go.
Yeah.
And I was playing it before it was released to the public as well. So I was playing it against very experienced players at Blizzard.
Right.
And
you inspect?
Well... No, because
were they,
it's not really...
Were they being kind?
Oh, most of them were kind. There was a lot of other beta testers, don't get me wrong. It wasn't just Blizzard people, but you could tell the ones that worked for Blizzard because they were pretty badass.
Yeah.
But you don't really go against other players. It's more of a go out, kill monsters, here's your mission, kill monsters, and if you do it, you get to go up a level. Right. Then you can buy some
new
things.
You're developing your character. Mm-hmm.
And then you do the same thing ad nauseum.
Dungeons and Dragons on a computer.
That's basically what it is. And I
Frank
thought, you know...
Frank just rolled a 7 and a 6.
Right.
Critical hit. Saving throw time, Bal.
More than I know the game.
You know way more about that than I did.
Hey, I used to play.
I never really played Dungeons & Dragons. I always wanted to, simply because I thought the art on the books were so cool looking. Mm-hmm. And then when you look through them and you see the swords and all these numbers, I didn't know what they meant.
They got this new kind of... 3D-ish Dungeons and Dragons thing out now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the name of it was. My son Peter wanted it for his birthday. And I got him like the main kit and a couple of the other ones. But I think he just wanted it because there were some dinosaur sets in it.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't played it. You know, he sets it all up.
Right.
And then he just like moves the dinosaur around.
Right.
Nobody else plays with it.
It's
just him. Yeah.
It's a toy.
Remember
when Dungeons and Dragons was all over the news? Oh, this is so evil and blah, 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 blah. And
kids are slipping into an imaginary world they can't get out of. Look at Tom Hanks.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.